Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. In the wake of the massacres in Paris, I couldn't help but bring to mind other massacres that occurred in darkened places where masses of people gathered for entertainment. My first thought, when I imagined myself as a victim on the floor, hoping someone doesn't shoot me, was it reminded me of the mentally ill man in Colorado who shot up a movie theater. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's terrorism or mentally ill individuals that are the cause. If someone has a semi-automatic weapon, they can kill a lot of people. It's not that hard, if you're willing to die, to commit mass murder. At least that is if you have access to guns. And we all know that the vast majority of Americans want background checks, don't want people with severe mental illness, don't want people on a terrorist watch list, don't want people with a string of murderous felonies to be able to easily get a weapon of mass destruction, namely a assault rifle, semi-automatic gun. But even if the vast majority of Americans, more than 90%, support these background checks, even if more than 80% of gun owners support these background checks, even if more than 75% of members of the NRA support these background checks, they never happen. They never happen. Even after Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook massacre, little children being murdered, they never happen. And everyone in politics says, well, you know, you just can't do anything. Doesn't matter that the majority of Americans support it, that 80, 90% support it, you just can't do it. And the question comes, why in a democracy would we say that if 80% or 90% of Americans support something, why wouldn't it happen? Well, the answer is, if you have a minority that's really loud and really, really cares about this issue and votes on a single issue, they could have more power than a majority. That's how the NRA has so much power today. But my guest, John Blake, who writes for CNN.com, covers race, religion, and politics, is reminding us there are historical examples for how to beat a single-issue minority. John Blake is a native of Baltimore, a graduate of Howard University. He's been honored by the Society of Professional Journalists, the Associated Press, and the American Academy of Religion, and he's the author of a book called Children of the Movement, which can be found on Amazon.com. John, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you.
So, how do you defeat a loud, determined minority that has lots of money and power and has politicians cowering for fear that you're going to go out against them like the NRA?
Well, history shows that there are different ways to defeat these groups. I think it's funny we're having this discussion right after, a week after, what's her name, Ronda Rousey lost? She was this fighter who was considered unbeatable and mixed martial artist, and this person came out of nowhere to beat her. And in politics, I think that happens a lot. There's a group that seems unbeatable because, like, say, the NRA, they have a vocal minority that shows up and they vote. But then history shows that a group can come out of nowhere and defeat this group, and it can happen. And I think there's, like, different ways it can happen. I think sometimes these groups overreach. Some people can point to certain, like, instances where a group, the rhetoric or some of the things they propose, it is so extraordinary that people react to it and see it in a different way.
But before we get to that, let's just sort of set it up here. So the National Rifle Association used to be, until I think the 1970s, maybe even the 1980s, basically a group of gun enthusiasts, right. Kind of like a sporting association, kind of right. Like the, you know, you could have the National Soccer Association or the National Bowling Association. I don't know if that exists. It probably does. You know, it's just best people who like to shoot and hunt and fish, and they were going to teach each other sort of the best methods and stuff like that. It developed into a political organization, I think, in the 80s. You probably know more than I do.
Well, I think it was around 1977.
So it was the 70s.
Kind of a coup where a certain group kind of took over the organization.
And at that time, yeah, they became a very solid political organization. And
right.
To this day, they oppose any legislation right. on guns, anything. We had a bill in Virginia last year to prohibit giving a loaded handgun to a 3 or 4 year old, and the right. NRA said we oppose that
right
because we want those 3 year old toddlers with guns. I guess they didn't quite say that, but why they opposed it, no, the reason they said they opposed it is they said we don't want, and this is, I remember this, they said we don't want the camel's nose under the tent. If you stop 3 year olds from arming themselves and shooting mom and dad, what's to prevent you from stopping a trained hunter whose profession it is to shoot a wild boar and who's in his 40s? I found it to be a ridiculous argument.
Right.
But they've got a strong minority of people. They're a minority, but they're loud, and they right. care. And if someone is about to be a delegate in the Virginia House of Delegates, which I'm about to be, I can tell you, the people who care about their guns really, really care. They write me a lot more than the majority of Americans who don't.
Right. I think we can draw lessons from tobacco, big tobacco. At one point, they seemed unbeatable with the money and the advertising. But I think one of the things that really helped turn the tide on them is that people were able to reframe the issue. Smoking ceased to be this cool thing you did, but it became a public health issue. And some people say that the same thing can happen to guns. If it's reframed as a public health issue, if states get involved, start passing laws in certain places to restrict or control gun ownership, that's how you start. That's what happened with smoking. So some
is that the problem, that guns are considered cool? Is that part of the problem, Hollywood and others?
Well, I think it's part of that, but, God, you know, guns in America is so tied into so many things. It's tied into race and our history. People say it's a Second Amendment right. So I think it's more than cool. It's like part of American identity. But smoking was seen as something like that, too. I mean, if you looked at Humphrey Bogart and all those old movies,
yeah,
that was like a definition of American masculinity, to have a cigarette in your mouth. But that was changed when the CDC got involved. Smoking started releasing these commercials that showed people, you know, looking like cadavers. When states start, you know, passing little smoking bans, the momentum built. And it got to the point where you had this point, I think around 1994, where big tobacco executives testified before Congress. And they said, oh, we don't think smoking is addictive. And people say, you're crazy. And that shifted the whole tenor of the debate. And the same thing can happen with guns.
Let me ask you about commercials, because Mayor Bloomberg of New York is the I think he's the founder or CEO, I forget his title, president of Mayors Against Guns, and he's spent millions, maybe even billions, hundreds of millions of dollars to help promote gun control. In fact, he did so in the most recent Virginia election.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if our commercials, his commercials, are not tough enough. You mentioned big tobacco, one of the most powerful commercials I ever saw, and it made me wince. I mean, it really, I couldn't watch it. I closed my eyes. Was the woman who stuck a cigarette in the hole in her neck
right,
that had been
right.
taken out because of her lung cancer. And it was disgusting. It was horrifying. It was awful. It's kind of like those commercials about abused dogs. I've seen those too. I can't watch
yeah.
those either. How about, and this is gruesome, and I know it's gruesome, how about showing pictures
yeah.
of the kids in a lump of bodies at the Newtown Massacre? It's 5 and 6 year olds massacred, dead bodies. I know it's ugly. I know it's horrific. But maybe you need to show people the results. Maybe this gun violence is a little too clean, a little too antiseptic, and people, and there are going to be complaints. How dare you show that on TV?
Right, right.
But maybe people have to be confronted with the results of gun violence, just like we did with cigarettes.
Well,
what do you think?
It's odd, you know, striking that you mention that, because I know a mom who has done exactly that. She was I don't know if she was a parent of one of the Newtown victims, but we did a whole series on this kind of fraternity of people who've lost people to mass shootings, and she lost a daughter. And when she goes around and she talks about her daughter, she shows people the autopsy photos of how her daughter's body looked after those bullets teared into it. So, I mean, that is one possible route to put this in people's face so they can't be detached about
it. I think about the Vietnam War, that very famous photo of that young girl running naked from the napalm.
Yeah.
That changed people's minds. And again, it's not a pleasant photo. And I'm sure there are plenty of people that say, don't show me that. Don't bring that into my living room. But, you know, guns are coming into your living room, and you better see it before you feel it, because feeling it is worse than seeing it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a battle of ideas. And I think the NRA has been very effective about rooting gun rights into the history of this country and the Second Amendment. So, you know, people have to be able to really deal with that and come across with ideas that effectively counter that.
Yeah, I'm tired of this nonsense about the Second Amendment. People say that to me, like you can wave it and suddenly it ends. That's not what the Second Amendment says. That's not what it's ever said. And people who say that, the Second Amendment, folks, does not protect the right to bear arms. Read it, folks.
It says
a well-regulated militia being necessary to security of a free people, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, necessary security of a state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It says we have the right to have militias, and no one's trying to take any guns away from our National Guards. It does not protect that. The Supreme Court said it did 5 years ago.
Right.
For 200 years, they said something else. And now people act like it's always been that way. This is a newly created history. I just had to say that.
Now, wasn't there a Supreme Court justice before that who said that whole argument was one of the biggest bunk?
It was Chief Justice Warren Burger, who's a conservative, who said that it's an absolute bunk. This is all about militias. It's all about militias, well-regulated militias. And no one can tell me that a crazy man who thinks he's in a Batman film walking into a Colorado theater is part of a well-regulated militia. He just ain't.
Right.
So anyway, so when people throw the Second Amendment mantra at me, you got to correct the record, because otherwise people start to believe, I guess we do have a right to kill people. It's right there in the Second Amendment.
No, it's not. But you know, it's a powerful argument because people do believe that, and they can point to the Constitution. It's there in black and white.
It's funny. When people are trying to impose religious freedom, when Kim Davis is trying to keep gay people from getting married, I can say, the First Amendment, you can't establish a religion. It's right there. And, of course, that would be right. But you don't see people talking about the First Amendment as much as they talk about the Second. So let me go back to this issue of a strong, loud minority. Because I have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about how it is that people who are part of a strong, loud minority actually trump the will of the majority, at least for a time, and then how to defeat it. Folks, if you want to call in and join the discussion, it's 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
He's a Bible-quoting, Constitution-loving, flag-waving, red-blooded, liberal American. He's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275. And now, the voice of reason in an unreasonable world, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is John Blake. He is an author for CNN, for CNN.com. He's the author of Children of the Movement, which can be found on Amazon.com. And he's talking about how to defeat powerful, entrenched minority opinions like those that make up the National Rifle Association. I got a number of callers on the line. John, I'm going to get to them, and then we'll definitely continue our discussion. Let's go to Trevor in Massachusetts on line 3. Hey, Trevor, how are you?
Hey, Mark, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
You know, I agree with you on a lot of things, and I appreciate debate. And as always, I'm calling to say you are wrong on this issue. I don't look at this as a Second Amendment issue or NRA. First, let me just say I'm not an NRA member.
Okay.
I'm a black man that lives in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I look at the tradition of firearms as individual acknowledgement of being able to defend yourself.
Okay, but Trevor, I'm not trying to take away your gun unless you have a string of felonies or you're on a terrorist watch list or you've been declared mentally ill. So I just want to be very, very, very clear about that. I want to take guns away from the people who murdered people in Paris. I want to take guns away from the person who thinks they're in a Batman movie and shoots people in a theater. I want to take guns away from them. Can you agree with me on that?
I want to be very clear. I could agree with you on that.
Okay.
Except that those are very subjective opinions. Who
decides they're not.
Who's crazy when you don't know?
Well,
who's
if, the,
crazy
what if there's a court order? What if you have due process and there's a court order that says you are a danger to others? Or what if you've been making threats? Or what if the guy in Charleston, that horrible killer down there, who told his friend the night before the killing he wanted to go and shoot a bunch of black people? Those and his friend took away his gun. Took away his gun, but returned it to him because he was afraid to be accused of theft.
Let me tell you why what you're describing is kind of pie in the sky. You wouldn't be able to determine these things through a due process. And any process that's put in place would automatically be subject to the discrimination of people versus other people. The whole reason that gun control came into play was when a well-regulated militia, the Black Panthers, decided we are going to patrol our own streets. That well-regulated militia went into due process where they said, you know what, new process, y'all ain't supposed to have guns. So I'm not looking at it from the standpoint of supply side. You can stop violent people by making sure they don't have guns because violent people are going to be violent people. None of the folks
you know
that
what?
Stuff
if
in
the
Paris,
terrorists in Paris had knives instead of guns, maybe they could have killed two or three or four people.
But there's
maybe.
No law you can pass that's going to stop the terrorists who are not law-abiding citizens.
Sure there
Any
is.
Law you would
sure
pass
there is.
Would
what you
stop-
do, you want to know my law, Trevor? It's very simple. If you want to sell someone a gun, you run a background check. If that person is on the terrorist watch list, you can't sell them a gun. If you are wrongly on the terrorist watch list, you go to court, you say, hey, that's not me, that's another guy with the same name, you get off the list. But
and
safety
again, I'm
first.
Say how that's going to disproportionately affect people and in effect say certain people can't have guns.
Well, I don't want terrorists to have guns.
Let's
I'm fine with that.
Let's make a process that you go and you get a permit and then you are allowed to have a gun. Well, if your name is Jamal X, you don't get a gun. Why? Because somebody has subjectively made the decision Jamal X can't have a gun.
No, but it shouldn't be subjective. It should be based on objective standards. You've committed a felony. You
but
are someone who has threatened
those objective
people.
Standards would only be applied to people who try to do the law. And the people in Paris, can we agree? Clearly were not trying to be in the law. They weren't trying to have their views.
The people in Paris, if they're on the terrorist watch list, would, according to the law I would pass, not be able to get a gun. They wouldn't be able to do it at a gun show. They wouldn't be able to get internet.
I'm pretty sure that they didn't go to a gun show to get their guns, is what I'm saying. It's kind
well,
of
in America, you could do it on the internet. They probably had a terrorist group supply them.
But in America, if you were a terrorist, you wouldn't go to a gun show to get your gun.
You could.
You would go to the
really
terrorist office to get your gun.
You really could.
The only people that would go to a gun show would be law-abiding.
Okay,
people.
But Trevor, since you and I agree that we could have that people who are mentally ill or on the terrorist watch list or who've committed a string of violent felonies shouldn't be able to own guns. You and I agree on that. You simply have a law and give people due process. Can you agree with me on that?
I can agree with you, but I want you to acknowledge something.
Real quick, because
we've
got a break.
Due process has, through our history, been used to exclude who you want to exclude.
Due process isn't
and
perfect, but you know what?
No due process,
but you know what, Trevor? I don't think, Trevor,
himself.
Here's the thing. It's one thing to put someone in prison. It's another something to give someone a gun. I will err on the side of saying someone has to go through a few extra steps to have a gun. We don't let everybody drive either. You got to pass the test. We'll be back. Sorry, John. I'll get back to my guest, John Blake, right after the break.
Back to the Aggressive Progressive, Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is John Blake. He's written an article about how to stop the NRA, basically arguing that even a determined minority that pays off a lot of politicians can be stopped if the paradigm changes, if the majority changes. John, in your article, you talk about the Anti-Saloon League 100 years ago.
Right.
And how they were a force actually more mighty than the NRA.
Right, right.
Yeah, they actually, some people say that they, the NRA, learned from the ASL, the Anti-Saloon League. And but, yeah, they were incredibly powerful, more powerful probably than the NRA now. And it was said that the leader of the group, Wayne Wheeler, could make and break presidents, senators. And they passed, they helped bring about the passage of a constitutional amendment. I mean,
that was prohibition to prevent the buying or selling of alcoholic beverages.
Right. But within a couple of years of the passage of that, they were a toothless organization. Their power collapsed because there were certain unforeseen developments that they couldn't anticipate. And some people thought they also overreached, and people rebelled against them as well. So they were seen as unbeatable, but things changed. You asked something earlier I want to get to.
Yeah.
Probably one of the most interesting arguments I've heard about how a group like the NRA could be defeated. They point to demographics, and people talk about this thing called the Coalition of the Ascendant. And one guy, I forgot his name, but he made the argument is that the primary supporters of the NRA tend to be white males, but the demographics of this country, they're changing. And as this country becomes browner and a new group comes forward, that group is going to lose power. And that's what happened to the Cuban lobby that I talk about in my article. There were all these Cubans in Miami, had tremendous political power, but their demographics changed.
The older Cubans supported a blockade of Cuba, but the younger ones didn't. But I got to tell you, sometimes the NRA rhetoric is spreading. You just heard from a caller, and I don't screen my calls. You know, this is Trevor from Massachusetts. He's an African-American man, and he clearly has bought into their rhetoric hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I remember his argument. He talked about the Black Panthers.
Right, right.
And there is a tradition in the African-American community of self-defense. I mean, a lot of African-Americans grew up in the South during segregation where they couldn't trust the police to protect them, so they had to have guns. So I think Trevor also spoke from that tradition as
well. I think he did, too. So how do we both protect ourselves against the mentally ill, deranged person who shoots up a movie theater or the terrorist group that shoots up a stadium and still make Trevor feel comfortable that, you know, we're not trying to take arms away from law-abiding citizens here?
Well, I think you answered some of those questions. You know, you talked about background checks, screening out mentally ill. But I think actually Trevor, as an African-American, his point of view actually represents a minority. The numbers show that people, Latino groups, African-Americans, Asians, are much more supportive of gun control laws than other groups.
Because they find that guns are more likely to be used against their communities than for their communities.
They are the primary victims of a lot of violence. Yeah. I mean, I went to Baltimore recently, and I talked to a guy who was a former gang member. His name is D. Watkins. He wrote an article in Salon about this. He was like, I hate guns. I know what they do. They've killed all my friends. I believe in gun control. So people like Trevor, he's African-American, but I think he represents a minority point of view. Other people of color want more gun control, and as they gain more numbers and gain more political power, I think that will weaken the NRA.
I got a number of other callers on the line I want to get to at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Let's go to Gene in Santa Fe on line 4. Hey, Gene, how are you?
Hi, Mark. You had a good point about the kind of commercial that would get people's attention about gun violence.
Yes,
which
I mean, it's gruesome.
Unfortunate.
But I think it may be necessary.
Exactly. And then you also mentioned the abused animal commercials that you and many of us cannot watch.
Right.
A commercial showing gun owners in rural America who shoot their animals instead of taking them to a vet to be euthanized would have the same effect as the abused animal commercials. So I think you have a good point there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to assault people's senses. I don't want to ever do it, you know, gratuitously. I mean, unless people love, I don't like movies with violence. Frankly, I don't watch them. You know, even Quentin Tarantino, it's like, all right, a little too much for me. But if it serves a purpose, you know, to stop a war or to prevent animals from being damaged or by all means to protect children from gun violence, I think we sometimes have to show people the truth, because when we hide the truth, we end up leading to more deaths. So if it saves lives, I'm willing to assault your senses.
Yeah, hey. I hope someone picks up on your idea and produces such commercials.
Well, maybe John, next time he talks to Mayor Bloomberg, can tell the mayor that I support his efforts, but he needs to be a little more graphic, a little more gruesome to shake up people up. John, do you have a comment about the commercials?
Yeah, I think there's another path out there. There are commercials that don't have to necessarily be graphic in your face, but they can be very well done and clever that can really get the point across. And one of probably the best gun control commercial I've seen shows a man going into a workplace with a flintlock, and he takes it out to shoot one person. And, of course, everyone scrambles in terror.
A flintlock is like an old-timey gun.
Yeah, and it says the ending is guns have changed, so should now gun laws.
You know what? And instead of a flintlock, he should bring in a musket, and then he should have to put the thing they use to clean it, stuff it down in, and he should load it. I could just see people in the bank as he's loading up his musket. That would be by the time he gets it ready.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fair point, though. It's a good point.
Yeah. Some of the problems with something like that is that people have become so desensitized with all the videos that it's nothing to them. It's entertainment.
Maybe. But I think there's a difference between cartoon violence and real violence. I think people, you look at the reaction to the murders in France, and people understood the difference between real violence. Even the reaction to Newtown. And I just think that people, every time it happens, whether it's, some small town in Oregon or Tennessee or Colorado, everyone's like, we just didn't think it could happen here. And my thought is, well, where have you been? Are you not an American? Don't you turn on the news? If it can happen in a small town in Oregon, yes, it can happen in a city in Tennessee. I mean, come on, wake up, folks. And so I think of course it can happen where you live. It's happened everywhere else, at least in America. It doesn't happen in Europe or Australia where they have decent laws. But thanks for your call, Jean.
You made a good point that people just don't pay attention. They go to work, they go home, they drink their beer, they get on their boat on the weekend, and they do the same four things over and over again.
And then they see it, and it affects their life. I mean, this guy in Virginia whose daughter was murdered on television, awful, awful thing. I think he's a gun owner, but now he is out there in Virginia, good for him, talking about these laws, strongly supporting them because he lost his daughter. You shouldn't have to lose a family member before you come to the realization that this is a really bad thing you have to do something about. I would hate it if that were the standard. You have to get someone in your family murdered before you try to stop, because it can happen to you. It can happen anywhere. Thank you for your call, Jean.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Let me go to Reggie in Georgia on line two. Hey, Reggie, how are you?
Happy hump day to you, Mark, and to your guests, too.
Thank you.
Well, like I said, as I said before, and I'll say it to you again, that you have these people on talk radio like Dana Loesch, who herself is a gun owner with a husband and two kids, who always touts the Second Amendment, whatever. Massive gun shootings have happened. And remember I told you that she also recently did an ad for the NRA, a gun ad for the NRA, and she also wrote a book about Hands Off My Gun, as if anybody read it. Although I think she should stick to her day job as being a radio talk show host and not an author or anything like that.
Okay.
But, she always touts this Second Amendment whenever massive gun shootings have happened. And she hates Mayor Bloomberg and Moms on Demand.
I don't really care what she thinks. My view is I care about children more than I care about guns. Maybe I'm weird, but I actually care more about a five-year-old's life than I do about the ability to shoot an AR-47 or whatever, 17.
And like you said, they always bring out the fear-mongering and the worst of people, saying that they're going to come, that Obama's going to come and take your guns away.
Right.
As if he can go door-to-door all over this country, let alone the planet, to do that.
Well, that's what they do. So let me ask John. I mean, how do we deal with these camel nose under the tent article or arguments or slippery slope? Or if you stop three-year-olds from owning guns, you're going to take away all our guns. It's patently ridiculous. It's like saying, if you tax me 1%, you're just going to confiscate all my stuff. Or if you have a speed limit of 55 miles an hour, next you know we'll have a speed limit of 1 mile an hour and no car could go anywhere. So I'm against all speed limits. It's obviously logically ridiculous. I don't know if there's a way, John, to confront something like that.
Yeah, please tell us.
Well, it would be difficult for me to say, because then I would be giving my opinion. And that's not something I'm free to do, in the context of this. I can talk about what I've written, but I.
I'll be fair to you as a journalist then.
Yeah.
But let me ask you. Okay, how about if I can ask you this? Okay. Are slippery slope arguments?
Yeah.
Have they worked in other contexts, whether it's the Saloon League or Big Tobacco or the Cuban refugees, other things that you've talked about? And how, in historical sense, I'll ask you this as an expert, have these arguments been met?
Well, like the anti-Saloon League, sometimes they've been met not by a counter-argument, but by something that happens in the world that no one saw coming. Like, for example, the Anti-Saloon League, when the Great Depression took place, nobody anticipated that. But that was part of what did that argument in. I mean, all these slippery slope arguments about if America's consumed by drink, we won't be able to function, whole families will be split apart. All that suddenly seemed to be so empty when this Great Depression hit,
and
the country had no money.
Yeah,
and they needed money to function, to keep the lights on. And what was the primary source of revenue? Alcohol, taxes
right.
on that. And so people's attitude changed very quickly when it came to those arguments they needed to keep the lights on and keep the country functioning.
And I would hope that these attacks that occur day after day, along with gruesome graphic footage, might be that kind of thing that shocks people. I don't know. Reggie, thank you for your call. Let's go to Old Faithful Michael in the Bronx on line 5. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hello, Mark, and hello to your guests. I got several answers to your questions.
All right.
First off, how you stop a three-year-old from having a gun. First of all, what the hell is a three-year-old having a gun to begin with?
Well,
if he's not
what
even,
happens is...
Wait. If he's not even old enough to drive a car.
Yeah, no, but it is legal in my home state of Virginia to hand a loaded gun to a three-year-old. We tried to pass legislation to prohibit it, and the gun lobby stopped it. They said, nope, let parents decide what to give to their children. It's not the role of the state to tell a parent not to hand a three-year-old a loaded gun. Apparently, the state can say you can't have this stuffed animal because an eye could come off and choke a baby, but you can still give the infant a gun. It makes no sense.
But since you mentioned about the NRA, I got a big scoop for you guys, and this would probably would stop them. And I encourage my fellow listeners to go to NewYorkDailyNews.com. That's NYDailyNews.com. And today's front page, it pointed out that over 2,000 suspects on a terror watch list have legally bought firearms in the U.S. because gun nuts are blocking laws that would end this madness. And
well, that's actually a great point, Michael, because it responds to Trevor from Massachusetts, who said, you know, terrorists, they don't go and buy stuff off the internet. You're saying that this Daily News article, New York Daily News article, says actually they do buy guns off the internet.
They're actually coming, if I'm understanding this correctly, I got to probably reread this. They're actually coming into the U.S. to buy the guns. And guess what? The NRA, led by Wayne LaPierre, not only has pushed Congress for years to block that bill, block any kind of gun safety reform, but then they back the no-fly list loophole. They actually encourage these terrorists to purchase guns. So now the main question should also be, is the NRA, which the Daily News is calling them, partners in terrorism?
Well, it's
should
a fair point, Michael. Let me raise it to my guests. John, do we know the extent that terrorists are getting guns legally in the United States?
I don't know the answer to that question. I am familiar with that article, but I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, it's a fair point, Michael. You would think that Republicans would care about stopping terrorism, at least, and one of the easiest ways to stop it is these gun laws. Got to take a break, folks, if you want to join the discussion. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back right after this.
He's a Fulbright scholar, and he speaks French, but he couldn't tell you who won the Super Bowl. It's Mark Levine. Give him a call now at 888-488-MARK. That's 888-488-6275.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. My guest is John Blake, who covers race, religion, and politics for CNN.com. He is an honored journalist. He is a native of Baltimore, Maryland. He is the author of Children of the Movement. This can be found on Amazon.com. He's also the author on CNN.com of an article that says how the NRA can lose. So we've talked a lot around the issue, John. Let's bring it home. How in 2015, do you believe we could effectively defeat the NRA, which after all represents a minority opinion, but a very loud minority opinion? We talked about commercials. What else can we do?
Well, I mentioned also the demographic change.
Right,
I mean,
that's true.
No one expected Barack Obama to win the White House in 2008. But the country had changed so much that people hadn't realized how much it had changed.
But that's a passive thing. I mean, the demographics change slowly over time. What's something we can do actively?
Well, actually, I think what that showed in 2008, that demographics tend to change a lot more quicker than we realize. So, and also, I think if the CDC got involved and started to study guns like they did with smoking, and if they classified it as a public health issue, and you saw those kind of guns, you saw that kind of research and money flowing to the issue, that would make a change, I think, also.
I don't think gun owners are going to listen to the CDC. I think for them, it's not about facts. It's about almost a religion with them.
But those gun owners tend to be a small vocal percentage. It's getting the rest of the people who are indifferent to this issue aroused and engaged. That's the key. They did it with smoking. There were people who saw it as something cool and didn't really think too much deeply about it. But then they saw those commercials. Then people began to classify smoking as a dangerous health issue, and people began to get emotional about it. The same thing can happen with guns.
One of the things I find that's interesting is that when you look at background checks, for example, so 92% of Americans support background checks. 85% of gun owners support background checks. 75% of NRA members support background checks. Three quarters of the NRA, the leaders are not listening to their membership. How do we get them involved? Responsible gun owners joining with us to stop irresponsible gun owners from handing loaded guns to three-year-olds.
Well, I think what you can do with what happened in APEC, that is, you can form alternate gun groups. I think that's happening right now because people say one of the ways you can deal with this issue is to force a wedge between the NRA leaders and their membership because they have different views on
it. So call something Gun Owners of America or Responsible Gun Owners of America or something like that.
Yeah,
is there an organization like that? Does it exist? Can we support it? Is there a Responsible Gun Owners of America? Does it exist?
If it doesn't, I'm not sure if it does. But
well, maybe that needs to be created. Maybe we need to get some gun owners getting together and supporting reasonable regulation. Actually, that's a great idea. I really appreciate that, John. Michael from the Bronx is still holding on. Michael, we're running out of time, but you got time for one last thing to say. Go ahead.
Thanks so much. I think the easiest thing, if I'm understanding that the NRA is being partners with this terrorism, with their encouraging the loopholes, and the Republican politicians that is in the NRA's pockets, that is something for the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, to look into. Because as far as I'm concerned, harboring terrorism is treasonous, it's sinister, and it has no place, and it's a crime in the U.S. And
I get your point, and I appreciate your call, Michael. I always appreciate when you call. So, John, that last point, connecting the NRA to terrorism. I mean, the whole country obviously opposes terrorism, 90-plus percent of us. We were all very upset by 9/11. We're upset by Paris. Is that tie, do you think that's a way to defeat the NRA?
No, I don't. I think that's a stretch. I mean, I don't think connecting the NRA to I just don't see that really working. I mean, people are so fervent in their beliefs of the right, fundamental right for people to have guns.
Yeah, so they're not going to buy the argument that someone off the terrorist watch list can easily buy a gun. I mean, to me, it's a background check issue. It's the same thing with mentally ill people. It's just that I don't want to take away guns of responsible people, but these are people who preach an ideology of mass murder.
It makes sense, but as someone else pointed, if Sandy Hook didn't change people's mind, what kind of rational argument is going to change people's mind? I think at this point, rational arguments are maybe that's not going to thing that's going to do put the kind of clip the power of the NRA. I think
maybe so, and I realize that an argument not arrived at by logic, arrived at by emotion, can't be defeated by logic. But to me, when you say if Sandy Hook can't do it, nothing can. I think that leads to a certain defeatism. I think it leads to people quieting their voices. I got to tell you, my constituents in Alexandria, Virginia, we had a public meeting just a few days ago, and half of them, they could raise any issue they wanted. Half of the issues they raised were reasonable regulations to prevent gun violence. So I will keep speaking out. I won't be defeated. And I'm afraid we're out of time,
okay.
John. I'm not saying you defend that either. I'm just saying that I don't want to give up. John Blake of CNN.com, thank you for calling on The Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine. Follow me at Mark Levine Talk.